and I guess it also didn't really show the relevance. But I want to say I'm new to APAHA, and I was really excited to see that there was this interest group, you know, this community of people who are interested in complementary alternative medicine. My sociology PhD was looking at the use of Chinese medicine in the United States, and this is from a study that we did a little while ago, now actually getting to it, where we were studying overall treatment of children in chronic pain. And part of what got me involved in that study was my interest in CAM. So, all right, the technology. Where do we push? Just the arrow? Can that work? Okay, so no relationship to disclose. And so let me give you a little bit of background. Chronic pain, so this is a study of, specific illness with kids, and there's a lot of overlap, so it was really a great panel to be on. So chronic pain is a significant problem in children and adolescents, and the reasons why: it limits physical and academic and social functioning, it's associated with psychosocial distress and lower quality of life, and unmanaged chronic pain in childhood increases risk of long-term pain and impaired functioning across the life course. And though chronic pain continues to be a challenge for conventional biomedicine, it has been shown to be amenable to CAM treatment. It's pretty cool. So we wanted to find that. So let me talk a little bit. I made a little change in my notes. I apologize for me. So, okay. I was not going to do this. Okay. So the next thing I wanted to do is just look at how it is that CAM treats chronic pain. And what I wanted to say to you is, like, just pose the question, why do you think that children and adolescents would be interested in using CAM? And what we found in this particular study was that, we compared three clinics, I'll show you in a minute, but particularly in the pain clinic, it's an integrated clinic, and they had a choice of quite a few different CAM modalities to use in the clinic. But we found that there was a preference for three modalities, and the preference was for biofeedback, yoga, and hypnotherapy. Those were the ones that the kids preferred. And so I'm going to show you some clips on the theories of those. So what I want to look at is I have some quotes, and then I'm just going to summarize the common features, because the quotes, each one has gives you the theory of how their modality works and also their broader goals in the treatment. So for biofeedback, and these are quotes from practitioners who worked in the clinic. I can tell you where they're from a book if you're interested. So the more pain you have, the more stress you feel, and the more stress you feel, the more pain you have. So that's the theory, that through biofeedback we can attempt to break the stress-pain cycle. But then self-empowerment is the ultimate goal of biofeedback training. A child uses the training and equipment to gain skills in body awareness and response control. As he, that's what she wrote, develops skills, his symptoms may lessen or disappear. He will increase energy, confidence, and may be able to stop using medications. So that's biofeedback. And then yoga, this was Iyengar yoga, and she called it therapeutic yoga. These were one-on-one yoga sessions that they had. They weren't classes that they went to. So in therapeutic yoga, the yoga series is matched to the healthcare needs of the child and changes as the child progresses. The yoga poses are intended to correct health-related problems, both in body structure and in internal organ function. But yoga is not just a series of exercises simply designed to build strength and flexibility. It is a vehicle for developing awareness. It's a process that develops strength of will, trust, confidence, and a willingness to look at oneself without judgment. Kids who practice Iyengar yoga for their chronic pain problems begin to see that they have some control over the underlying causes of their problems. And then the last one, hypnotherapy. Children with chronic pain generally require a calming of the nervous system. The use of hypnotherapy and guided imagery influences this process, as well as provides support for strengthening the immune system, release of stress and pain, and other healing goals set by the child. Many of these goals are emotionally based, such as reducing sadness or worry. My goal for the child is to learn how to help him or herself to heal and stay well. So although these are three different modalities, each one of them has an understanding of mind-body interaction, right, as its core theory. So the theories link mental processes and physical symptoms, and they also show, that developing self-awareness and self-efficacy is connected with the physical healing, which can be pain management or elimination of the pain. Another theme going across these three was that the patient's active in this process. And if you look at the role of the therapist, it's not so much that the therapist is doing the treatment so much as they're training the child in something that they can do themselves. And they also emphasize that the treatment is individualized to that particular child, not just the therapist's assessment, but even what the child wants, right? That the child helps to set the goals of the therapist. Okay, so now we'll try to just go through a little bit of background about the study. It was an interdisciplinary and mixed methods study, so it had quantitative and qualitative components. We had a quantitative survey, lots of measures. I don't do that. We also had two qualitative components. One were in-depth oral history interviews, which we did before the kids saw the therapist at the clinic, and then 6 months after, so there was pre and post. And we also videotaped their first intake meeting at the clinicians, and those intake interviews were analyzed using a method called conversation analysis. But the findings today are based on the interviews. So who participated in this study? We recruited kids and parents. I forget what it's called. Sequentially, as they made appointments with the clinic, we referred to us and we invited them to participate. And so people who were willing to participate did. We ended up with 74 parent-child pairs distributed. It was meant to be comparative of three clinics, but nonetheless, the majority of them were in the pediatric pain clinic. High percentage, almost half of them, presented with multiple diagnoses. And then in terms of my analysis, there were 55% of the children where they really talked about the CAM in the interview. So those are the ones that I use. And just say, well, what kind of pain problems did they have? And so these were the main diagnoses. And you can see it's more than 100% because oftentimes there was more than one the problem that they were complaining about. Kind of wide-ranging, although somewhat different from what you would see in adults in terms of what their main pain complaints were. And then also, what was their experience, seeking treatment before they came to these specialized clinics? And you can see, when I was reviewing this, it kind of surprised me. It took almost 4 years before they sought out specialized care, that they were going to other types of biomedical treatments. So the average was 19 medical visits in the last year. And they also, you can see, they saw a lot of doctors, right? That half of them, it was 1 to 5 doctors, and actually a little bit less than half, so more than half saw more than 5 different doctors for their pain. So let me just ask you, so far, what do you think? So why might these kids with chronic pain problems be interested in trying CAM? Any thoughts? Anybody want
to? It seems like the other things they tried didn't work very well.
That the other things they tried didn't work very well. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Side effects from the other
treatments.
Might offer them something they can do for themselves.
That they offer them something that they can do for themselves. Yeah, absolutely.
Some of the chronic pain is not really well understood, mm-hmm. and so we may be giving them medication with the side effects and everything else without the medication, without really understanding what it is. So,
yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. In fact, that's what a lot of the kids said. The kids said that the doctors don't know what's going on with me, and they're giving me this medication. It's not doing anything, and they were kind of upset about that. So absolutely, yeah. Those are all very good points. So we had this question, and we used kind of a standard qualitative methods for getting at the point of view of the participants, which is a grounded theory method of constant comparison. I'm not going to go into this, but if anybody wants to talk about it later, I'm happy to. So this is Mike. I put the summary in here. So what we found, there's actually been two sets of analysis looking at these looking at somewhat similar questions. And so what we found was that there's kind of a set of what I'm calling push factors that made kids interested in trying CAM, and that was this whole list of negative experiences with biomedicine, some of it ranging from just that it wasn't really working, and some of it more, more upsetting things where they felt that people didn't listen to them and that it created a lot of upset. That people were throwing things at them without knowing what was up and creating false hope and things like that. And then on the other hand, there were some pull factors, which also you could probably start to imagine what some of those might be. And the pull factors had two parts. There were some of the kids actually had expectations, things they were hoping to get from CAM that were really initially also pulling them towards it. And then others described it was once they actually tried CAM that their positive experience is what kept them using it. And then I added facilitating factors, but I didn't really incorporate it into the talk, but just that it was also clear that whether or not kids chose to use CAM were influenced by things like whether their parents, in fact, I have some strong sort of, parents were open to it. That made a huge difference. And there were a couple of really sad cases from my point of view where kids were very excited about trying CAM, and I guess the parents were initially open to it because they participated at the beginning of the study and then they withdrew them, and so they weren't able to do it. So parents are really important. And then also with the kids, there seemed to be kind of a bifurcation. This experience with biomedicine, and I'll show you, it's like some kids just were still like, I'm going to find something. I'm going to go out there and try everything I can do to manage this pain. But other kids became very fatalistic and resigned and really depressed about it and were kind of, like nothing's going to help, nobody can help me kind of a thing. So definitely it was more likely that kids who had that more positive attitude were going to be excited about trying CAM. So just summarizing the push factors to see the connection, so it was both treatment failure and also invalidation of the patient experience that turned them off to biomedicine. And the results were rather significant that over time, and if you think of this from a mind-body perspective, right, in terms of not only, something I think about is that there's kind of an iatrogenic effect, that over time, rather than helping in any way, these encounters with biomedicine contributing to making the pain worse in terms of looking at these kind of effects. And then, when we were analyzing the data again for specifically focusing on CAM, we added a few more things. That there was a theme in the interviews of the standardization of biomedicine that the kids were saying. They just felt like that every new doctor they went to just had a standard protocol they threw at them, which wasn't really tuned into who they were, their needs and their experiences. And then somebody else said that too. It's interesting, it wasn't as much side effects as some of these more cultural things, like worrying about dependency and stigma, and then just the lack of treatment effect, which I guess the earlier study noted that one as well. So let me summarize the pull factors. So the positive experiences with CAM providers are one. Then the direct benefits of the CAM treatments, there's another. And then finally, the individual approach, things that kids really appreciated about CAM. And then the rest, I just want to share with you some of the quotes that related to each of these. And there's a little bit of overlapping. I don't know how we're doing on time. Are we doing okay? Okay, so looking at what they said. So with regard to the experience with practitioners, for instance. So the interviewer, I like this one because the interviewer said, how are your therapies now? So to asking them, you know, about the treatments. And so the child said, well, I like them. And then on her own, she volunteers, and the people are so understanding. So you really feel from this, it's like how important that aspect was to her. And this is, they know what they're doing. I feel like I'm actually with professionals. You know, in the context of the whole interview, you have to realize this is also a comparative statement, right? They know what they're doing, and they're professionals compared to who? So that's a pretty powerful statement of how this child experienced that. And then this one, actually, it covers both the experience with the practitioners, but also experience with the treatment. So I'll just go through the whole thing. So the child says, oh, I don't like my doctors. I've never liked my doctors. I've never liked doctors. The only doctor I liked was my chiropractor. What makes him different from other doctors? He's explanatory. Is that a word? Yeah, does that mean he explains what he's doing? Or, well, he explains everything, and it makes sense, and I can feel it instantly. So going on to, you can feel it from the words he says or from what he does? What he does. Like, I wasn't able to walk for a month and a half. I went to him for 2 weeks, or no, for a week. And the only reason I was able to walk was because of him. I was just getting better and better by the day. It was simply just because of him. That was the only actual thing I've ever seen in my life happen that worked without drugs. Even with drugs, things don't work, but this worked. Vicodin, I'll get a headache, I'll take it, the next day I'll have it back. It just postpones it, it seems like. With him, it went away, the day before my birthday, too. Pretty cool. So in terms of some additional things about the perceived benefits of the treatment, in fact, this one was the one where there was the most expectation, before they actually used CAM. So here the question is, well, why did you decide to go to this clinic in the first place? And the child says, well, because I want to be able to function. I'm not on a high dose of medication, but it's a lot of medication for my body, is her perception. And she said, I want to figure out if there's anything that's as effective as medication is, but that's less harm to my body. So in fact, she was drawn to this clinic in particular because she knew that it would offer these kind of alternative treatments. And this one's, I think, similar. What are you hoping for from the pain clinic? I'm hoping for more overall relief of the pain. The drugs are okay, but because of the dependence and the diminished effects, they don't help as much. But maybe a way to detox my body so that I could kind of go for 3 days with no narcotics whatsoever and kind of clean my system out and start over with low doses. Hopefully that could help or something, and maybe try the yoga thing. But the main thing I'm thinking is biofeedback. I think biofeedback is going to be the only way that I'm going to be able to get better. And then, excuse me, in terms of the individualized approach, you'll see, I'll give you a little explanation of how I interpreted this. You can tell me what you think. But so the interviewer says, it sounds like they helped you to understand your pain differently. And she says, well, probably to cope differently and understand. Yeah, I think that coping and understanding are sort of together. I know that I'm very tense, so that's part of understanding. I know I'm very tense, I have a tense personality, and also that I'm physically very tense, so I need to learn how to relax. And I think I want to point out that this was a follow-up interview, and this child didn't have this self-awareness, wasn't thinking this way before. So, you know, it's that idea that through this practice, she develops a new understanding about herself. And so she says, now I know how to relax, I know how to stretch, how to strengthen, I know things that I can do to help. I also know that it's okay to be in pain, and it's okay that I feel the way I do. I don't know how to explain it, just that they understand and that they're trying to help, and that's really therapeutic in itself. So this is one of the quotes that really means a lot to me, because it also, I don't know how important this is here, but something I've been thinking about in terms of this issue of patient-centered health outcomes, you know, and that so this thought that, well, oh, you need to cure it, right? The pain needs to go away for this treatment to be successful. And here, even the child is saying that a big part of the outcome here was this validation, you know, that she's okay, right, the way she is, and that people understand her and they're trying to help, that how much that outcome was so was already valuable in and of itself. I don't feel guilty now. I can work on improving it. And then just, I think it all comes so slowly. So just that whole perspective, I think it's really powerful. And then the last one here, I guess then the best thing for a researcher is to, oh, there was a question at the end, is there something else you want to tell us that we didn't ask you about? And so she said, I guess then the best thing for a researcher in this subject to know is that everyone is absolutely completely different. There are those really general ways of trying to gauge someone's level of pain, but at the same time, really make adjustments for those people who are really struggling with the whole 1 to 10 scale. You know? pain is really not, think about it, how weird is that? This is something in your body, this is something that's affecting you mentally and spiritually and physically, and they're asking you to rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. It just seems like such a frivolous thing to do, really. It like belittles what you're going through on many levels. I just think people should try to understand it as not just something, well, we're going to structure it this way, this is how it's done, but really be a person. So her appreciation of that individualization and that she was getting from the camp. Okay, so in summary, the adolescents in the study choose CAM because they're pushed by negative experiences with biomedicine and overly standardized approaches to treatment. They're pulled by positive expectations and experiences with CAM and its emphasis on individualized treatment. I'm going to skip the other two because I didn't really talk about them. And then just conclude with some overall comments about the findings, which is that I would say that you know, some of the takeaway points is that there are some important social factors and benefits associated with CAM use for children with chronic pain. And the social factors that seemed really important were the patient-provider relationships, the relationship with the CAM therapist, this individualized approach to treatment, and that was this other part that I didn't talk about, having some social support for trying the treatments was also important. And the benefits, you know, like as I said, not just that the pain might go away, but that they gain self-awareness, they feel validated, and they do gain some control over the pain and the treatment. So, thank you.
Thank you. I couldn't make it earlier to hear the earlier presentations. My apologies to the presenters. I started teaching mindfulness practice at Harvard Medical School 3 years ago because it's very apparent that this is the way to go in medical school. And and one of the aspects that I think is critical here in terms of the last person from bed, I mean, I was glad the patients came with charts, is that when you talk to chiropractors, for example, this goes back 40 years, they spend time, they have courses in how, in what I call snake oil treatment. They had, just like the doctors did in previous generations when they went to people's homes, they took time. The insurance companies don't allow time. But they get trained in, you know, selling their product. And they also, as I already mentioned, time. So I think this is a part of the dynamic, is that when you have, like at Harvard Community Health Plan, you have 7 minutes allotted, you can't even do with biomedicine. And you have to throw things at patients rather than listening and really hearing. And also, in my generation, that was not emphasized, the art of medicine. So I think thank you very much for both your presentations. I just also say that I've worked with adolescents in Boston who were very similar. They weren't, well, some of them had been incarcerated, but most of them not, but they will be. And we were working with using mindfulness meditation, not in a formal way. And I can share later some of the interesting stories, if anybody wants to give it to them.
I think what the quote really spoke to me so beautifully was that they were being treated as a person, and so the practitioners were cultivating a placebo response, and the biomedical providers were absolutely just treating the object body. And so they think the practitioners, just as you said, they were spending time relating to and treating the person.
Have you looked and compared your results of those two groups? In terms of the efficacy?
Yeah, how the response, how well they did.
We haven't yet. That's extremely important to us, and we haven't looked at that yet. We actually have noticed, though, that, so we just tell parents to stay on their community treatments and speak to their physician. We want to be completely independent of whether or not they lower the dosage or raise the dosage. And the kids, when we start the intervention, are in second and fourth grade. So they're growing. So they, if they're on medication, they typically, the usual trajectory will be they'll increase their dosage. But actually what we found is the neurofeedback group remains constant, and the cognitive training and the control groups both up their dosage during, in between time one and time two.
I guess I'm a school nurse in middle schools and in high school, and we, many families choose here in San Francisco not to medicate. And that, those are the children we're out for struggling with around intervention. So really honing in on that group and how they respond. And I certainly am going to talk about the meditation and yoga reading with them. But
it would
be, that would be
really interesting. Yeah, we're starting to pull that data together. So we're also extremely interested in that. Because just the first day in terms of working with the students, a child who's medicated versus a child who isn't comes in, and they're very, very different child. And you know, the child who is normally medicated, if they come in, they'll tell you, I didn't take my pill today, and they might be jumping on the chair. You know, sit them down. We use a little biofeedback device called a stress eraser. They practice their breathing for 5 minutes, and we think that that primes them to complete the computer attention training. So we'll see. I'm also interested in that. Thanks for asking.
Well, I wanted to thank you all. Outstanding presentation. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Alternative Complementary Health Practice Group. And, you know, for a lot of people in this country still think of CAMP as something that wealthy suburbanites do at their spa. And I don't want to cast any aspersion on that. But for my entire career of 35 plus years, I've never worked at a spa, and I've done acupuncture. And I work with populations, of course, like you talked about here. So I think it's so crucial that you're all doing the very kind of work that you're doing and reaching out to that. And our group within APHA really wants to support that. So in whatever way we can do it, having you here to talk about this, we want to be open to promoting it. It's really important.
Any other comments? Yeah, I guess I just like to second that. I work in the international arena. And I come from a medical background, and I went into it because it was an interest in prevention. And 30 years ago, preventive medicine residencies hardly existed. But I feel in hearing the really excellent speakers and what you shared from your heart, but it seems that there's such a large volume of lack of mindfulness in the yoga that just we're kind of chewing around edges with these symptoms that come in, whether it's chronic pain or headaches or stress or whatever, the need for the yoga, the meditation for everyone to bring down kind of, there'll still be illnesses, we'll still have illness, but we'll be working with a subset, and we won't have a mass demand on our nurse practitioners, however efficient we get, we'll never be able to be efficient enough for the mass need that everybody's crying out. And you know, trying to bring down the tone of this so that, you know, I've been doing meditation yoga all my life, but I found it after medical school. It's been, you know, in my 20s. So how do we bring that to 4-year-olds or 2-year-olds and getting it to children before they're incarcerated? It's excellent work on incarceration. But how do we, you know, it's hard to prevent some of that, but there'll still be problems. And maybe a bit less severe, a little fewer in number.
Well, I want to comment on that. I don't think the answer is anything we do. I think it's in beliefs and who we are. I had the privilege to travel to the east, to India, to Rishikesh this past year, and I heard many speakers talk about this, especially one who was actually trained in neurobiology at Stanford and left her PhD program to follow a guru in Rishikesh. So I got to hear the East-West mix. But I think a lot of it has to do with our beliefs. You know, we have beliefs in, for example, we're not connected. So that's the yoga means unity. We're all one. When we believe we're separate, I don't care about your problems, I care about my problems, and I'll focus more and more. And so some of these beliefs we have to change first. I think that we're separate, and also we talk about efficiency. We have this belief that there's not enough. I need mine. I need mine. But if you believe in abundance, for example, then there's plenty that I can freely give. If I have it, if you need some water, here you go, I have water. But there are our beliefs, I think, are part of it, including you know, the idea of not being present. Usually when we're not present, I wrote down some notes, impulsivity. Okay, we're not satisfied with the present, so we need to make it better. Need to make it better. Also, maybe some of you got in and like, were those were shitty presentations, let's say. Let's say you had that thought. I'm not saying anyone did. But you might go into that. Because we have expectations built upon the past, projecting out to the future, but not being present and experiencing what it is. So I think all these things of being present and mindfulness, but also our beliefs and lack of that we're connected with each other, that we're all one. I mean, a lot of times we believe it's separate individuals, and that's good. There are many flowers, but it's all part of one plant. So I think beliefs do with it.
Yeah, I'm wondering, in the current medical curriculum, how much time is youth devoted to talking about these other modalities?
I would say very little. I actually trained in do-it-yourself medical school, the Berkeley version, where we have problem-based learning and we develop our own curriculum. But in my years at UCSF, it wasn't anything that was addressed for everybody. But if you were interested, the OSTRA Center was available and you could learn more. But I think what I did find is when we were taught about complementary and alternative medicine, the two main messages were people are using it a lot, we don't really know what it is, and the other thing is to kind of, basically if you're taking a board question, if I just put my pediatric board, the answer is that might have risks too. So basically I have memorized my boards with the side effects of valerian root. I think the answer to one of the questions is actually that Inka Belova had cosmic patient seizure because they had altered the metabolism of her seizure medication. So you basically learn that there's side effects from it, there's a lot of it, we don't know what it is, but it might be beneficial to your patients. You might want to offer it, but there's not much evidence about it. That's my experience.
I just said that because that would be very, I would love to come back 40, 50 years from now and see how things change.
It is changing. I think if the work of the interest group, you know, bringing people like us up to talk, I think that it will become more prominent in medical schools because there's recognition that so many patients are using complementary and alternative medicine, but at this point it's still a little bit like all the other, and we're starting in general to have a more positive attitude
with it. Thank you all for coming, and hopefully you'll come to more sessions.